sharp augmatic eyes had spotted her already. Halina Kurtex. She was no inquisitor. Sensor templating and psionic pattern recognition had registered enough positives. Disguise, masking, juvenat treatments. They could all hide a lot. But I was reasonably sure that Halina Kurtex was in fact the arch-heretic Lillian Chase. The Cognitae, the oldest, greatest, and most pernicious cult of chaos in history, was present in the person of their legendary and elusive leader. Only something like the Keeler image of Horus Lupercal had the power to draw her out of hiding. My long and bloody work was about to be completed. Half an hour before the start of the sale, I was summoned to see Medinai. He was in a private chamber. His mouth, all smiles as before, greeted me at the door and led me in. Medinai the Eater had stopped being a functional human being many years ago. His appetite had got the better of him. His pallid physical bulk, a pyramid of flesh that weighed over 9 tons, was supported in a frame of suspensor pods and lifter bars. He no longer had discernible limbs. Gangs of slaves worked to massage oils into his flesh to keep it supple, a never-ending process, while trains of servitors carried in a ceaseless procession of foodstuffs that were fed to him by hovering cyber-drones high in the framework rigging. It was hard to make out his actual face, just a small dot near the summit of the mountain of meat. "My dear Inquisitor Eisenhorn," he said, using his mouth, "I wanted a word. I have a feeling that today will not end well. I want your assurance that you will not seek to prosecute me."
"You have staged a sale, Medinai," I replied. "I know of no laws you have broken."
"Your assurance, please, sir."
"You have it. May I say, Medinai, that if you feel this auction will go badly, you should not have orchestrated it."
"I would not have," his mouth said, smiling. "I worked to arrange a private sale for the image, a private sale, but it was not to be."
"What do you mean?" I asked. My psychic powers detected a slight tremor. Fear, perhaps, or trepidation. The infinitesimal artificial delay between Medinai's thought process and its delivery by his mouth avatar gave me a window into his mind.
"I decided an auction would be best,"
his mouth was saying. "I was forced to arrange this sale against my will," his mind was thinking. I threw myself to the left. Lasbeams, bright as a sun's heart, scorched the ground where I had been standing. Medinai had been coerced into this face-to-face meeting, too. I cursed myself for not realizing sooner that a man like Medinai the Eater, so ashamed of his physical state that he used an avatar for personal interaction, would never request to see anyone in person. I rolled hard, incidentally knocking the mouth off his feet. The teeth of the trap were 2 cyber skulls, sweeping down from the high roof space, their las kill systems cycling for a second shot. A beam scored the floor behind me. Another struck the mouth as he rose, cutting him clean through. He dropped again with a gasp, face down, spattering the tiles with the gore and internal organs released by his bisection. High above in the rigging, Medinai's real mouth wailed with pain from the psychic feedback. I cut loose, unleashing my mind at the grinning cyberskulls that whizzed towards me. 1 fierce mental jab, and I blew out the auto-control mechanisms, freeing them from the psionic impulse that directed them. 1 plunged like a meteor into the ground and exploded. The other whistled over my shoulder at high speed, out of control, and smashed against the chamber wall. Sparks showered down from Medinai the Eater's rigging. My jab had burned out Medinai's telekine array, too. 3 men burst into the chamber. I recognized them as members of Halinor Kurtex's entourage. They were heavy-set, powerful, fast, and psych-shielded. I went for my sidearm, but the first was on me. He had a hooked dagger, which I blocked. I rolled backwards, hurling him over me onto the floor. I was back on my feet before he was, and swept his legs out from under him. Turning, I drew my transverser handgun and cut down the other two. The impact of the shots smashed both of them down hard. The first man landed on my shoulders, his arm around my throat, bending me backwards. Only the wrist of my gun hand was stopping his dagger from plunging into my face. I threw an elbow, but it didn't connect. The man's strength was augmetically amplified. He was an engineered killer, a lifeward or a cognite murder form. I have been crippled for decades. My feet, legs, and lower back are sheathed in a heavy scaffold of metal calipers to allow me movement. I stamped backwards with one iron-shod boot and crushed the arch of the killer's left foot. He snorted in agony. His grip slackened slightly, and I tried the elbow again. As he reeled backwards, I swung around and struck him across the head with my transverser. He fell sideways, his skull cracked, blood squirting from his ear. Shots tore past me. More members of the Kurtex crew had rushed into the chamber. They were firing hard-round auto pistols and las snubs. I fired back as I ran for cover, smashing through a row of startled onlookers, bemused servitors with their trays of fine food who had come to a standstill, order systems shut, and were watching the pandemonium unfold. I knocked two clean over, and they fell, spilling their trays. Ambush fire from my would-be killers ripped into the line, dropping more of the confused slave units. Plates smashed. Trays of gourmet food crashed to the ground. My attackers fanned out across the room. My shots, snapped off between the milling, bewildered servitors, were driving Chase's men into cover on the far side of Medanai's mass. One of them had holstered his pistol and was deploying a rotator cannon from the pack on his back. I ducked. The raking fire ripped across the floor, chewed through the servitors, and demolished the tiled decoration of the wall. Chips of enameled ceramics and glass from the ornate windows showered in all directions. I heard the cannon's motor whining as the gunman changed munitions packs. Shots screamed in from another angle. This was fire from a hell gun. The shots, placed with indecent accuracy, exploded brackets on the rigging that supported Medanai's mass. There was a long, ugly shriek of metal giving way. Then the whole 9-ton bulk of Medanai the Eater rolled sideways, hurling servitors and squealing slaves into the air. Medanai rolled like a landslip and crushed the killers where they crouched in ambush. One survived, broke free, and ran. Another hellgun shot detonated his head. I rose cautiously. The air smelled of smoke, blood, food and skin oil. Slaves were wailing, weeping, nursing broken limbs. Harlan Nail padded into view, his hellgun up to his cheek and ready to fire. "All right," he asked me. "Fine," I replied. Nail had been my advance agent. "I was wondering where you were," I said.
"Keeping out of sight, like you told me," he said.
I looked at the tumbled mass of Medanai the Eater. He was alive, helpless, mewling. Slaves were struggling to right him before his own body weight compressed his organs into failure. The blood of Chase's men seeped out from under him. "I gave him an assurance," I said.
"I didn't,"
said Nail with a grin. He knelt beside his final kill, rolled the body over, and fished something out of the man's jacket. He showed me. An inquisitorial badge. Nail raised his eyebrows significantly. "Cognite, Harlan," I said. "Posing as Ordo Hereticus." He shrugged. "We have to find Chase."
"You mean Kurtex?"
he asked. "That's the name she's using."
"It's really her?"
"Seems so," I said. "I can't believe we finally got this close."
"Well, it's been a jolly journey getting here," said Nail. "The fun, the friendship. The journey's more important than the destination. Isn't that what they say?"
I looked at him. He sighed.
"Just trying to lighten the mood," he said.
"Chase will want the Keeler image," I said. "Come on." Death, gunfire, and word that the Ordo Hereticus was cutting loose had caused panic in the palace. Guests and prospective buyers were fleeing with their entourages. Nail and I pushed through the press of bodies and made for the side chapel where the image had been put on display. Sajan Caryl was lifting the Keeler image off its stand. His hands were gloved. An armored carry casket lay open at his feet, ready to receive it. "Helping yourself?" I asked. I aimed my transvasor at him. Caryl smiled ruefully.
"I think the sale is off," he said. "And this is something I am anxious to obtain."
He laid the glass plate gently in the casket and turned back to the display stand. Under the velvet cushion was a small packet. Keeler's writings. The real prize.
"I can't let you take that," I said. "Halina Kurtex. Have you seen her?"
"No," said Caryl.
He was busy with the packet, opening the seal.
"Leave that," I said.
"Think carefully, Caryl. When did you last see Kurtex?"
"She fled, I think,"
he said. He smiled.
"It's funny. I never thought I'd be grateful to the Ordo Hereticus, but thanks to them, this is now mine."
Nail took a step towards him, his Hellgun aimed.
"My boss said put it down, so put it down. You've got some front. There are two guns trained on you, and you still think you're going to walk out of here with that."
I glanced around. Caryl was confident in something. But what?
"I should thank you too, I suppose,"
Caryl said to me.
"But for you, the Order would not have driven this operation. And Kurtex..."
"She isn't Ordo Hereticus. She isn't Halina Kurtex," I said. "Her name is Lillian Chase." Caryl looked at me. An expression of delight filled his face.
"Oh,"
he said, laughing.
"I had thought so highly of you. But now I find you're adult like all the rest. Lillian Chase! You're so wrong, it's hysterical."
He opened the packet and began to read.
"Delightful,"
he murmured.
"Keeler is quite explicit. The Emperor is not a god. He disavows any effort to name him so. You see, here? She states that it was her encounter with demons in the presence of Horus Lupercal that drove her to extremes of belief. If demons exist, then, to her, a god must exist too. The universe could not be so cruel otherwise. The existence of a god was necessary to counterbalance the horror of the warp. The Lectitio Divinitatus is based on a lie. Imperial faith is based upon fear. The saint admits it."
"Hand that to me," I said. "It is a deeply heretical text. It's going nowhere."
"This?"
Caryl smiled, gesturing with the papers.
"This is just a bonus prize, our reward for being patient today. It will make a nice addition to our library. It doesn't tell us anything we didn't already know."
"You are cognite," I said.
"Yes, Gregor. Lillian sends her regards. She had hoped to meet you in person one day, given the years you've been searching for her. But she's busy elsewhere. She sent me to collect this. Your road ends here."
Nail raised his Hellgun and aimed it at the man's head.
"I don't think you're in much of a position to issue threats like that," he said.
"I'm not," said Caryl. "Today, this sale, it was a sting operation. The Ordo Hereticus learned that Med and I had the image. They knew it would be an irresistible lure to heretic groups. They coerced him into announcing an auction rather than trying to sell it privately. They knew the Cognite would send an agent to get it."
He grinned.
"That's me, by the way."
"Halina Kurtex," I began.
"Is an inquisitor,"
he replied.
"Ordo Hereticus. She's running this operation. This sale was bait for the prize she's after."
"The Cognite?"
"Gods, no! A far greater heretic. The renegade Psyker. The Diabolus. Gregor Eisenhorn. This was all for your benefit, Gregor. You are a wanted man here. Your ex-masters, the Ordo Hereticus, want you ended.
From the halls behind me, I heard screams and the sound of weapons fire. With Nail covering Caril, I went back to the chamber door to look. Ordo Hereticus kill teams were sweeping into Medinai's palace, slaughtering every living thing they could find. They had co-opted Tempestus Scions to do the blood work. I saw Inquisitor Curtex among the stormtroops, ordering them on, relaying messages to find me and detain me at all costs. I had believed I was setting a trap for Chase and the wretched Cognite, but in truth, it was a trap set for me. I was impressed at the skill and flair with which Curtex and her colleagues had lured me out of hiding. I was horrified to see, now more clearly than ever, how much of an outcast I had become. To the Ordo Hereticus, I was as abominable as the Cognite. Today, the Cognite were but a footnote, and Chase had used her opportunist cunning to lift a great treasure while the Ordo and I kept each other busy. I had been outplayed by both sides, the Cognite and my former masters. I felt sick. The Ordos were blind if they could not distinguish between me and a threat as malevolent as the Cognite cult. I had been right to cut my ties and continue my work alone. That knowledge gave me some small comfort. Harlan cried out. I turned to find him knocked to the ground. Caril had the sealed carry casket in his hand and was aiming a lasgun at Nail. Impressive. It took a lot to outsmart Harlan Nail, especially when he had a gun to your head.
"I'll be leaving now, Gregor," said Caril.
I shot at him. My blasts withered in mid-air. Caril, or whatever his true name was a high-function psyker. That's how he'd floored Nail, and why he had seemed so confident. He'd hidden the power earlier, but now it was boiling out of him. I took the brunt of it, and it hurled me back into the wall. I felt several ribs break. But, at last, someone had underestimated me. I was a high-function psyker, too. Caril had power, but Chase should have sent someone with considerably more. Staying in the dark places had its advantages. People didn't know what I was truly capable of. Chase did not appreciate who she was dealing with. My power had been blocked earlier by the Inquisition's mind shields. Now it was free, and it was fueled by my anger and frustration. I yelled a single word of power. The force of it, like a flaming shockwave in the air, struck Sajan Caril and threw him not just into the chamber's back wall, but through it. Stonework ruptured. A terrible, blinding light shone in through the demolished hole. I pulled down my glare shields and helped Nail to his feet. He pulled on his goggles, too, and we drew up the heavy hoods of our coats. Outside, the desert was too bright to look at. The heat was immense. While we had been inside the palace, Loday had ended, a brief night had flickered past, and Burn Day had begun. Caril lay on his back on a heap of rubble. Every bone in his body was shattered, but he was still alive. Blood from his wounds was cooking off him, and his exposed flesh was frying. He held the packet of Euphrates Keeler's ancient manuscript in one blackened claw of a hand, but the paper was already burning. He was trying to put it out, but he was on fire too. I watched his body burn, the papers with it. "Get Medea on the vox," I said to Nail. "Tell her to bring the gun cutter in. We need rapid extraction." He nodded, and I heard him speaking glossier into his vox headset. I opened my mind.
"Cherubel, can you hear me?"
"Of course, Gregor."
"I need your assistance."
My, Gregor. Do you need me to come and kill lots and lots of people for you?"
I hesitated. I thought for a moment of the Tempestus Scions and Inquisition teams ploughing through the palace at our heels, just minutes away from finding us. "Yes," I said, with great reluctance.
"I didn't quite hear that, Gregor."
"Yes." Nail and I took the armored carry casket and set off into the burning desert. Medea was en route, less than a minute away.
We got a fair distance clear of the palace, and I turned to look back, in time to see a light come down from the sky that was brighter and more dreadful than the burn-day glare of the three suns. Medonai's palace began to die with volcanic finality. I looked away. From somewhere I heard a deep, satisfied laugh. It was probably the demon host, delighting in his slaughter. But just for a moment, I thought it had come, echoing, from the casket in my hand. From the smiling, noble image that Euphrates Keeler had made so long before. That was the Keeler image, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Perihelion, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. An hour into the symposium, it became clear we weren't all going to get out alive. I'd come to watch, to spectate, covering my identity with the paperwork of an archaeolinguist from Shurfath, the local universitariat, and disguising my face and build with scholar's robes and a falsehood, I'd come to sit among the academics and the savants in the gallery. I lie. I hadn't come to watch. I'd come to see him. It had been a long time since I'd last seen him. 50 years. A century. I lose count. Bader Vikam had died. That was the start of it. Bader Vikam, 11th son of an 11th son, the last discernible branch of a noble house line that had ruled the island nation of Maleficer for 30 generations, had died. You know the island, I'm sure. In the cold, green northern oceans of Gudrun, in the Helican Sub, a place of mild summers and dark winters, of ice-capped peaks and geothermal power, of ancient towns etched into the steep sides of dead volcanoes. To the north of the island, the jagged black walls of the continental shelf can be seen on a clear day, 300 kilometers away, across a forbidding polar sea. House Vikam had a seat in Gudrun's upper legislature, but it had never been one of the most powerful or influential of Gudrun's noble families. Over the centuries, Maleficer had been sustained by the export of preserved fish, seabed ores, and by geothermic power, but it had always maintained a reputation as a seat of learning. In those steep, cliffside towns there flourished Shurfath Universitariate, 2 academies of rubrication, 6 museums, and 4 distinguished library collections, all thanks to the scholarly enthusiasms of the noble Vikams, amateur philologists all. Now the last was dead, without issue, of terribly old age, and Maleficer was to be administered by the Vikams' mainland cousins in House Corell. Bader Vikam's famous private library was to be broken up and dispersed into the discipline libraries of Shurfath, as well as several mainland scholams. There had always been talk that House Vikam's private library contained some items of unusually esoteric merit, and, as is often the case with old collections long held in private hands, the Inquisition had appointed an emissary to oversee the disbursement of its contents. One can never be too careful. Even without any malicious intent on the part of its owners, a 1,000-year-old collection might have something pernicious festering at the back of a shelf. I have personally seen great tragedies unfold because of the unwitting ownership of the blasphemous. I have seen a page of faded manuscript kill a world. We gathered in the empty house, high on the steepest scarps of the island's peaks. It was the end of autumn, and the first ice was glinting in the harbour. The first dark, deep ocean gales were building out in the west. Migratory birds mobbed the skies outside the high windows, preparing for departure. Servants hurried from draughty room to draughty room, nursing warmth out of the corroding heating systems that Bader Vikam had allowed to ail alongside his health. Inquisitor Syriac led the symposium. With his interrogator, Voriet, and 3 savants, he had spent 2 months sifting the collection. He was now presenting his conclusions to a body of his peers from the Ordos, along with an invited audience of academics for deliberation. 18 volumes had already been sequestered without consultation. The Inquisition does not invite opinion on some matters. But there remained 151 items where a strong argument could be made for careful academic study rather than strict prohibition. Chancellor Manivar of Shorefath was particularly insistent on this possibility.
"Shorefath's reputation," he said, rising to his feet at the start of the symposium, "which I may be so bold as to suggest extends beyond Gudrun and the subsector to the local Imperium sector range, depends so much upon the quality of our collection. And that collection, at its core, has been the great work of House Wickham, whose broad and admirable curiosity has allowed them to accumulate the vast and irreplaceable archive of books down the ages. While we understand the necessity of restricting some volumes, from time to time, for the social good, we urge the worthy Ordos not to sequester the entire catalogue. It is not all contaminated because of one or two unwise inclusions. Please allow as much of the whole as possible to be transferred to the academic files of Shorefath and its fellow institutions at home and abroad."
I was broadly in agreement with the Chancellor's wishes. I had reviewed the questionable pieces, and there was nothing in them that warranted censorship. Depriving scholars of access to such material blunts our collective knowledge. But, you may remark, I would say that, wouldn't I? I also liked Shorefath. There was something about the cold, hard climate of Maleficer that focused scholarly intent. Some of the most learned members of the sector's ordos had studied there at one time or another. I myself had spent 9 months there, trawling its stacks. That was many, many years previously, when I was attempting to do some background research on a matter that had occupied a colleague of mine during a visit to Elvara Cardinal. Though answers had eluded me, and the man was long since dead, I had come to appreciate Shorefath's atmosphere and learning. Inquisitor Syriac leant towards the Chancellor's way of thinking, too, but he was young, and this was one of his first formal duties. He knew that the eyes of seniors were upon him. He could not afford to seem lenient. He could not afford to appear radical. There's a potent word. Radical. The first volume was brought out for examination and discussion, the first of the 151 in question. It was going to be a long process. Syriac had chosen a small lecture room in the upper levels of the vertical palace, a gloomy, wood-panelled chamber of uninterrupted brown. It had once been used by Medicaid students for anatomy lessons, and there were tiers of seats around the central stage. The tiered gallery stalls, like a little box theatre, were almost as sheer as the cliffs outside. We leant on the wooden handrails and peered down into the gas-lit arena, where Syriac's savants, their hands white-gloved, were laying the first questionable book on a piezo-charged, neutralizing cloth. Boriat, the interrogator, had placed aversive wards around the lip of the wooden stage. There were guards, too, inquisitorial servants in the stern robes of the ordos, and the more ostentatious men-at-arms of House Wickham. Syriac began his review. The book was a copy of a copy of Eunasius's readings, one from which the notorious poetry had long since been expunged. It was undoubtedly harmless, an unloaded gun. The mezzo-picked illustrations were, however, charming and rare, and deserved to be held for the benefit of students of the visual arts. The Chancellor rose, and, once Syriac had finished his summary, said as much. The Ordo's seniors seemed unmoved. Old Carnot Vesher would be, I knew well, mono-dominant to the end, hard line, bitter. Adrian Corwell was harder to read. An elegant, diligent woman, she had her cyberdrone hover over the pages as the savants turned them, relaying close-ups to her optic implants. Zol Gogach seemed bored. I distinctly heard him twice ask an aide what the palace kitchens were preparing for dinner. And then there was him, of course. Faceless, implacable, as unreadable as a blunt.
It is not weakness to confess that I felt a certain emotional response when he moved from the shadows onto the stage. It had been a very long time, and we had once been very close. His career had been blighted by the affair of Slight. His career, and the Kell Mountain region of Saar Province. Gudrun, and Eustace Majoris, too, bore the scars of his work. I knew full well those modest scars were far preferable to the fatal exit wounds that would have been the consequence of his inaction, but Lord Grandmaster Rawkin had been obliged to censure him. In the service of the throne and the Hawley Ordos, he had been required to operate on a rogue status. He had saved, at a conservative estimate, trillions of lives. Even so, the aftermath had been a terrible mess. In order to continue in service with the Ordos Helicon, he had agreed to suspend his active status and fulfill an advisory role in the Inquisition's headquarters. A waste. A waste of a huge talent. At least, I had heard, he was writing again. The readings were finally passed for collation. His vote swung it, though his eye was the only word he uttered. I was glad to see that a fear of accusations of radicalism, a fear that he was the rogue they had always suspected, did not stay his hand. He knew what was right and what was foolishly wrong, and the mezzo-picts belonged in a decent library. The second work was brought out and introduced by Syriac. It was a tarnished copy of an M39 Ennead, where old block-printing transposition errors had created quasi-blasphemous images of the Emperor. I had honestly thought we would get all the way to item 16, a prayer pamphlet of the Technotic sect that had a genuinely heretical tone, before there would be any real dissent or argument. That would probably take up the whole of the first day. In one of the scheduled breaks, or perhaps after the evening session, I would steal my chance to talk to him. But it didn't go anything like that. As Syriac's savants turned the pages of the Ennead with their white-gloved hands, one of the House Vicom guardsmen at the back of the room, a tall fellow with a lugubrious expression, shifted uneasily. He was wearing a long green coat, a white sash, and copious gold braid, and his tall silver helm was festooned with the feathers of the oceanic greywing. He was holding a ceremonial poleaxe. I noticed him twitch for a second time, and thought perhaps he was suffering from indigestion or other gastric discomfort. Then he hoisted the poleaxe and, with a slightly bemused frown, plunged it into the nearest Ordo's guard. There was a prodigious quantity of blood. A major artery had been severed, and the force of blood pressure all but hosed the backs of the seniors on the stage. The mess did not concern me much, nor the sudden commotion, the shouting, the movement, or the production of weapons. The poor house guardsman, already surprised at becoming a killer, was positively astonished to be killed. An outraged inquisitional agent drew down and shot him at point-blank range, and he fell backwards, releasing his grip on the haft of the poleaxe, which was still twitching in time with the ebbing arterial pulse. My concern was the sense I had registered the moment before the killer struck. A tiny pulse of psychic power. The House Guardsman had been a puppet. A mind had used him. It had taken control of his limbs and forced his action before he'd even had a chance to resist. That was power. Worse, it was precision. There is only one thing more dangerous than a human psyker. It is a human psyker expertly trained by the Scholastica Psychana. I know. I am one. The murderer's executioner, standing over the body with his side arm drawn, suddenly became the next instrument of the invisible agency. He shivered. Then he turned and started to shoot wildly into the galleries and across the stage. One of the savants was cut down, and Syriac was hit in the thigh. Guards, both Ordos and House, who had rushed forward to help the first butchered victim and restrain his killer, scattered. Carnot Vesher was a psychic. Hurling himself out of his seat, the back of his coat soaked in blood, he yelled a command word at the shooter, who was one of his own retinue. The chilling use of will.
made me flinch. Vesher was strong, but his practice was clumsy. There was none of the stiletto finesse that had triggered the incident. The guard with the gun ceased his rampage, impelled by Vesher's will. He halted and looked down at the gun he was holding as if its presence in his hand was an utter mystery. Confusion had dulled everyone's wits. The guard with the pistol, stunned to inaction by Vesher's yell, was no longer the problem. The rogue mind had flitted on, leaving one slave for another. Another House Vicom guard, a captain, had dropped down beside the first victim, attempting in great earnest to ease the fellow's miserable death. The captain suddenly shivered and wrenched the offending poleaxe out of the first victim's torso. He rose, a brimming lake of blood around him on the floor, and ran the brute weapon at Vesher as one might run down a boar. The captain would have killed the Inquisitor cleanly, but for two factors. Vesher used his will again and screamed a frantic command of prohibition. The captain was too possessed by a superior mind for it to be truly effective, but it did make him hesitate, and his boots, decorated with velvet rosettes and brocade, slipped in the pooling blood. Instead of impaling Carnot Vesher's chest, the spike of the poleaxe cracked through the Inquisitor's left hip and pinned him to the wooden frame of the box gallery. His outraged scream was as considerable as the quantity of blood that he began to leak. Around them, guards of both stripe opened fire and cut the blameless captain down from several directions. They were all idiots. The mind had already moved. The galleries were emptying. Spectators, in great agitation, were fleeing to the comparative safety of the side rooms and the waiting chambers. I knew it was time to withdraw. The bloodshed on the little galleried stage, which had taken on the ridiculous quality of some gruesome pantomime show, had been just that, a show. The majority of the most powerful and capable people at the symposium were on that stage, and the attack had been designed to occupy them, to confuse them, to create a debacle that would entirely focus the attention of the audience. Their demise had not been the primary intention, however. If one of the Ordo's seniors had been the target, why begin with the guard? I was sure I was the true target. Somehow, some agency had learned of my presence. I seldom frequented public or populated areas, but someone had found out about this one rare appearance. Where had I slipped up? How had I shown myself? For many years, I had lived other lives, covering all trace of myself. Where had I made a mistake? What fragment of truth had I left uncovered? Was it simply my determination to meet with him here? Had that been my undoing? Who was to blame? Who had come for me? I am sorry to reflect, accumulated far too many mortal enemies. And I share the same arch-enemy as the rest of my species. I left the gallery and took the small back stairs, a dark flight of wooden steps with a tight turn. I pushed my way past straggling spectators who were making for the exit. Some cried out as I pushed them aside, afraid that death was coming to touch them too. I was armed with a power knife in a sprung sheath along my left forearm, and a Transvasa Auto in a flat holster under my coat, but my most dangerous weapon was inside my skull. I reached a lower hallway under the lecture room. The floors were boarded with gleaming black timber and dressed with old rugs. The walls were lacquered panels. Dim, ancient faces peered out of ancient oil paint scenes in ancient frames. Refugees from the audience had accumulated in the hallway, huddled savants and frightened scholars. When they saw me and read my grim sense of purpose, they shrank from me and fled. My disguise, especially the uncanny ancient technology of the falsehood, was good enough to cover me under regular circumstances. Sitting, walking, standing, I was just another figure of no consequence. But now I was moving with speed, and no amount of borrowed finery and optic deception could cover my bulk and my oh-so-mechanical gait in rapid motion. I was clearly no academic. I was still a tall, broad-shouldered man, and what damage life had done to my solid frame, augmetics have repaired.
servo-assist leg frames become obvious when one is running, and no one could mistake the martial training evident in my bearing. Vesha's brittle screams were still echoing from the lecture room above me. I believe that by then they were attempting to unpin his smashed pelvis from the panelling. I felt the rogue mind flick across me, hunting for me, fixing on my psychic aura. I wrenched the auto from my concealed rig, just in time. Shots came at me down the hallway, hard rounds. They drove into the wood panels like gas-gunned rivets, flecking the air with splinters. The scholars around me broke again, this time caught between my threatening form and the source of the gunfire. More shots. Two of the scholars were hit as they milled in front of me and crashed to the floor. I brought the Transvasa up, still moving. One shooter was half concealed behind a golden helm and carapace displayed on a pedestal. I fired, missed, but made the attacker duck back into cover. There was a second concealed on the other side of the hallway. He was firing a large-caliber pistol. I saw the muzzle flash of the weapon as a bullet hissed past me and aimed for that. I think I hit him in the hand or forearm. I heard a yelp. I used my will and declared, "Show yourselves!" Though they were both being slaved by the rogue mind, my raw command was enough to make them falter and stumble out of cover for a moment. Both were Ordo's guards, black-suited members of Gaugach's retinue. They were blameless and, like as not, would be free of control again in a moment. But I had not the luxury to show any mercy. Still running, I fired. Two shots to the left, to the right. Each round struck the middle of a forehead and knocked a man on his back. I had reached the end of the hallway. The door to a retiring room lay open to my right, and stairs were directly ahead. The scholars had all fled. I could still hear Vesha howling at a pain that would blight the rest of his life. "Who are you?" I asked, reloading. "Who are you? Where are you?"
"Who are you?"
a mind voice answered. Cold, crisp, the sort of sharp voice a blade would use if it could speak. I turned slowly, watching the doors and exits. "Who are you?" I repeated, adding will to the words.
"Who are you? I did not expect you. You were not anticipated. Who are you? Reveal your name."
The will force in the send almost made me speak my name aloud, but I bit back. So, I wasn't the intended target after all. I was, in fact, the rogue element, the unexpected player in the game.
"I know you. I can smell your mind. The rogue. The famous pariah. Long years since your rosette carried any authority."
The mind was strong. I pushed at it, harder, harder still. I knew the psyker was stronger than me, but sometimes strength isn't everything. I was hoping to outflank it with skill and practiced technique, to wrong-foot it. The mind sounded young, not experienced enough to know every trick an old dog has in his book. But it was hard to push, because the mind kept moving. There was a flexibility to the psionic pattern that was quite disturbing. It was fluid. It flitted like a wild bird from slave to slave, yet it did so with great purpose and accuracy. It was not simply ricocheting from one consciousness to the next. It was fast. Strong and fast. I pushed again. It slipped aside, but this time I came away holding some words, torn off its elusive subconscious like a handful of grass.
"Grail Ochre, the Yellow King."
"Grail Ochre, is that your name?" No answer. "Yellow King, of what?" No answer. "Yellow for cowardice. Won't you reply?" I pushed again. "What is Orpheus, Grail Ochre?" I asked. "Why does that word lurk so brightly in your mind?" The mind pushed back. Fire cored through the neural links of my augmetics, making me gasp and stagger to the wall for support. All my old wounds, all the artificial neurons spliced in to allow me to control my exo and endo augmetics, shrieked with induced pain. The cellular memory of injury and surgical incisions replayed.
clever, turning old pain against me, getting me out of his head. He was gone again. The house was alive with the sounds of shooting, of security teams rushing up and down the tight wooden staircases. I limped into the retiring room and pulled the door shut behind me. It was cold in there, unfriendly. No one had bothered heating it for the day. A limpid grey light fell through the tall windows. Drapes and tapestries hung dark like shrouds. There were shelves of books, some ragged furniture. I needed to sit down. I tried to let go of the pain he'd poured into me. This Grail Ochre, whoever he was, and I was sure a name like that was just another mask, a pseudonym, was cruel and exceptionally skilled. I had only stolen the few clues I had by brazen persistence and the fact that he had not expected another psyker to be in play at the symposium. He had lit me up with old agonies, ghosts of all the wounds and traumas I had ever suffered, and not just the physical ones. I was almost overcome with a sense of loss, of several losses, remembered grief. I saw faces, briefly, in my mind's eye, faces I had not thought of in years. Uber Amos, my long-dead savant, the irrepressible Midas Bettencourt, Fischig, stubborn to the end, Tobias Maxilla and his gleaming artificial life, Elizabeth Beckwin. He woke them up. Grail Ochre woke them all up and sent them to torment me for a minute or two until the pain ebbed away. "Why are you here?" I looked around sharply. He was right behind me. Perhaps he had taken shelter in the retiring room too, or perhaps he had been drawn to the flash of my mind. He was a dark shape, a shadow beside the seaward windows. It was as though he didn't want to be involved in anything. "You recognize me?" I asked. Of course. Even with the falsehood, I had a suspicion. "Is this anything to do with you? Today's little round of murder and puppet play?" "No," I said. "I thought someone might have been taking advantage of me making a public appearance. But that was arrogant. It's not me thereafter." "Does the name Grail Ochre mean anything?" "No." "The Yellow King?" "No." "I see," I said. "Was he ignorant? Or was he just not playing? Throne knew he had no reason to trust me. He hadn't had for years." I removed the falsehood so he could see my face. My scarred, expressionless face. "It is good to see you," I said. His vox speakers made a noise, perhaps the approximation of a sardonic laugh. I was not seeing him, and he was not seeing me. There was no expression, or even micro-expression to read, on my frozen face, and no nuance to prove that I genuinely was pleased. And he was just the chair, the armored, hard-machined, floating shape that stored and supported his helpless organic remains. He was seeing me through optical relays and speaking via voxponder circuits. The armored prow of his chair unit was no more readable than my features. It looked as though he had not maintained the exterior of his chair in a long while. It was scarred and scratched, and the paint was flaking. He had not bothered to keep up its sinister appearance for fieldwork. Spots of fresh blood dappled one side of the chair's armor. "Why are you here?" he asked.
"I came to see you."
"We have not seen each other for a very long time, Gregor. I had not expected ever to see you again."
"Times change," I replied.
"So do people. Neither of us is what we used to be. Rogues, the pair of us."
"You were only rogue by circumstance," I said.
"It cost me my career, and that implies you are not a rogue by circumstance. Are you really the radical they say you are? The diabolous threat that has five sectors looking for you?"
"What I am is immaterial."
"Not so," he replied. "Even if you are innocent, this isn't the time or place to prove it. Your reputation is accursed. You should not be here."
"I walk where I choose."
"Dark places. All of them."
"And I am not here to prove my innocence. I am here to see you."
which is why you should not be here at all," he said. Gunfire echoed down through the house. Upstairs, another attempt was being made to smoke out or kill the Psyker assassin.
"You could stop that. You could crush him," I said.
"No.
You're the strongest mind on the island. Once, perhaps. You won't use your psi to restore order here."
"Others will. Gogach and Korwal are closing the killer down. Another few minutes."
"Neither of them is strong enough."
"Together they'll do it."
"So why don't you use your mind anymore?"
I asked. "It was a condition of my pardon. The inquiry lasted 15 years, Gregor. Moloch made a terrible mess."
"Not as terrible as the one he wanted to make. The one you stopped."
"I agreed to retire from active duty. I swore to suspend my mind from psychic activity. I merely use the little mind impulse I need to control the chair and run life support. Nothing else. Nothing active. Not even telepathy."
"Why? The greatest mind of your generation."
"In a ruined body, with a shattered reputation. My mind and your body. There's almost one whole person between us. Almost."
I looked away. Even without the nuance of micro-expression on my part, he could tell he'd offended me.
"Your skin is thinner these days," he said. "It was a joke, yet it cut you. You never used to care. Are you so ashamed of the path you've taken?"
I holstered my weapon and readjusted my falsehood. "I came to see you," I said. "I know it's been a long time, but it was for something important. But I can see you've changed. There is no point bringing this to you."
"I'm sorry."
"I'll get over my disappointment."
"We cannot work together," he said. "We cannot be seen together, or have any association."
"Because I am a radical. Diabolus."
"Because I was given a choice after Moloch," he replied. "Retire from active service and refrain from psionics, or, on behalf of the Holy Ordos, hunt down my old master, the heretic Gregor Eisenhorn."
I did not know what to say. He had chosen the prison of his chair and the negation of his extraordinary consciousness over me.
"This thing," he said, "this psyker that has come hunting in the House Vecum today, I think it's come for me. I made enemies. Moloch, Kalzean, and their ilk. They had associates. They belonged to secret orders and clandestine fratries. Their kin want me dead. While I abstain from psionics, there is no satisfaction in killing me. They are goading me. It's happened before. They are daring me to use my psi again. When I do, I will become a worthy target again. Then they will exact vengeance and kill me. I refuse to play their games and rise to it. This matter here, this Grail Ochre, it will be done soon. Calm will be restored. Go now, Gregor. Go now, before they lock the place down. You cannot be found here, for your own sake, and for mine."
I nodded. I turned.
"Does the word Orpheus mean anything to you?" he asked suddenly.
"No," I said. "Another vox noise, the analogue of a sigh."
"Then, goodbye, Gregor," he said.
"It really was good to see you, Gideon," I replied. With a soft whir of suspensor mech, the chair turned to face the seaward windows. Ravener was no longer looking at me.
"I hope we never meet again," he said.
His voxponder was toneless. Covered by the falsehood, its resolution turned to maximum effect, I left the palace by the back staircase and exited into the deep hillside well of covered steps below the ramparts. An hour's walk down the steep black stairs that snaked down the windswept cliff would bring me to the harbour road. From there I could reach the boat dock in the shadow of Shorefarth Universitariate, where my launch was hidden, and quit Maleficer. Behind me, the sporadic sounds of gunfire continued to disturb the mountain air, and I could still feel a dangerous mind at large. I hate running from a fight. As it turns out, I wasn't.
That was Perihelion, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. The Magos, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day. What hours, oh, what black hours we have spent this night! What sights you heart saw, ways you went, and more must, in yet longer light's delay. With witness I speak this, but where I say hours, I mean years, mean life. Bones built in me, flesh filled, blood brimmed the curse. Religious verse, Terran, M2. Chapter 1. The Bone Coast. Sometimes, at night, the lights would wake him. It didn't happen often. These days there wasn't much traffic on the Bone Coast Highway. Cargo convoys now and then, the occasional freight tanker once in a while. Perhaps a fast transit, purring up the coast road to Delkey, or down to Tycho. By day he'd glimpse the dirty sunlight winking off their hulls as they rattled past. He'd hear their engines and the thock-thock of their heavy wheels on the highway's broken rock creek. The sounds of other lives with places to go, rushing past him, Doppler distorted. At night, sometimes, passing lights backlit his window blinds and drifted across the ceiling of his little bedroom. Very rarely, the passing lights slowed down, perhaps hoping his little roadside property was a tavern or machine shop. They'd speed up again as soon as they saw their mistake. Rarest of all, they'd stop. If they knocked at his door to ask directions, Drusha would answer them as politely and helpfully as he could. He didn't know much. He hadn't had much direction of his own for a very long time. Some didn't knock. He'd hear them outside, prowling around, trying doors and windows, boots crunching on the chalky gravel. Reavers, that was his guess. Road mobs. There were more of those these days, chancers and migrants from the lawless zones of the north. He'd hide in the back room, one hand on his gun, until they went away. He'd heard stories. He knew that one day they'd do more than just try the door. They'd kick it down. They'd come in. That night he woke to lights on the tatty blinds. They drifted above him, right to left, across the water-stained ceiling. Something southbound. It slowed, then was gone. Drusha lay back on his lumpy pillow and sighed. He stared up at the blank darkness and found it no less fathomable than his life. He'd been dreaming of something, something better than this. He wondered whether, if he closed his eyes and willed it, he could find his place in the dream again and pick up where he left off. The lights came back, left to right this time. They stopped. The same vehicle, reversing. He recognized the throbbing engine tone. He got out of bed. He put on his old spectacles with shaking hands. He didn't know what to reach for first, his jacket or his anxiety meds. Then he remembered he'd been out of anxiety meds for 3 months. He pulled his jacket on over his nightshirt and pushed his feet into unlaced boots. The lights went out. The engine died. That decided it for him. Anyone who pulled over to ask directions out here left their engine running. There were no lights on inside his property. He fumbled in the blue gloom and found his way to the hall. He heard boots on the gravel outside, someone moving around, to the left of the front door, then the right, casing the place. This was not how he wanted to die. In all honesty, he would have been pushed to make a list of ways he did want to die, but being beaten to a pulp in his own property by a foraging road mob certainly wouldn't have been on it. Drusha crept into the back room. He tried to remember where he'd left his gun. He didn't like guns. Never had. It had sat on the dresser for a while, a paperweight for some aging migration reports. But it had kept looking at him, so he'd put it in a drawer. That was it, a drawer. Which drawer? As quietly as he could, he looked in one, then another. He was on the third drawer when someone came to the door. He could see the front door from the back room. The shadow against the window lights was distressingly big. The owner of the shadow knocked. Hard. The sound made Drusha jump. It took a big, hard fist to make a big, hard noise like that. He couldn't help but fancy he was hearing, for the first time, the very fist that would eventually beat the life out of him. Idiot, he told himself. That's it. Paralyze yourself with fear, with fancy. Valentin Drusha's imagination was his worst enemy. He tried to remind himself of that. He could imagine far worse and more horrible things than his imagination, but that kind of proved the point. He found the gun. It was under a bundle of expired ration stamps, a broken clock and a coil of fishing wire. Of course it was. The ideal place. It was a small, chunky automatic, a Regit Arms .40 that Max had given to him years ago. He had never, ever fired it. Was it even loaded? She'd given him ammunition. Had he loaded it? If he hadn't, where was the box of ammunition? If he had, were the bullets still good? Did they go off? Was that a thing? He probably should have cleaned the weapon, too, the way she taught him. It was probably so corroded it had seized solid. Much like his life. The shadow knocked a second time. Drusha started again. He steeled himself and decided to do the bravest thing he could think of. He put the gun in his pocket and ran out of the back door. The property was a prefab shack set back 100 meters or so from the ragged coast highway. Drusha had lived in it for 7 years. It was weather-worn and set on waste gravel, shrouded by bleached undergrowth and gnarled saltwood trees. From the front porch, by day, he could see the ocean, but that wasn't necessarily a good thing. To the rear, where the property backed into the dust dunes and the ridges of silt, were the coops and pens and outhouses. Everything got covered in a fine white dust, blown in by the sea wind. At night, it seemed a ghostly place, the white dunes silver against the low black sky. The air was still. It was a warm night, breathlessly warm. Even in winter, the Bone Coast was a thirsty place. Drusha scuttled towards the outbuildings. Sweat was already dripping off him. He considered making a run for it, but there was nothing around for kilometers. The war, 20 or so years earlier, had scoured the peninsula. The area around his home was a throne-forsaken waste of bone-dry dunes, dotted ruins, inshore refineries long since closed down, and the rusted carcasses of ATV carriers. The remoteness and lack of amenities were key reasons why the place had appealed to Drusha, and also key reasons why he'd been able to rent it for a manageable sum. He remembered the landlord, a property dealer in Tycho City, actually smiling with relief when Drusha had signed the lease and forked over the first quarter rent. He decided to hide in the outbuildings, among the clutter. Most of the stuff had been there when he arrived. He'd added to it over time. Scavenging on the shore and inland had provided him with materials to use in various projects, the coops and pens, for instance, steel poles and wooden posts for frames, chain link and mesh fencing to make the cages, fuel cans hacksawed in half to make water troughs. There was some old sacking he used for windbreaks and lagging. He imagined himself under it, being very still. He froze when he saw movement. A man appeared, walking around from the front of the property. He had a stab light in his hand and was playing it around. Drusha's eyes had adjusted to the darkness. He made the man to be young, slight of frame, fair-haired. Then the stab beam pointed his way, and the glare ruined his night vision. He ducked down, wincing, and crawled behind a pile of rotting cargo pallets. They had been going to be a lookout tower, a blind from where he could observe the winter migrations, but he never worked out how to engineer the old pallets into a platform that wouldn't collapse under him. He heard the man call out. He heard footsteps on the chalky gravel. He dashed towards the pens and let himself in. It was musty and dry inside. The air stank of birdlime, and there were feathers matted into the cage wire. His menagerie fluttered and warbled at his arrival. There were 2 Tarconi Tarconil in the cage nearest the door, ailing creatures that he had found on his walks, one with a broken wing, the other matted with promethium. He was nursing them back to health, though he doubted either would ever be fit for release. Beside them, in the row of smaller cages, were various seabirds that had been grounded by a storm the previous winter, and seemed to have lost their migratory instincts. He'd fed them, and they'd stayed, pecking around the property, showing no signs of resuming their endogenous journeys. In his journal, he had written up each case, theorizing that the electromagnetic fury of the storm had screwed up the magnetoceptive faculties that regulated their migratory behavior. Either that, or it had caused some malfunction of the trigeminal system. They had lost the motivation to go on, and had forgotten why they were supposed to. Sympathizing acutely, he had taken them in. In the end cage, beside the feed store, was the foul-tempered sea raptor, Gortus Gortus Gershomi. It hadn't been foul-tempered when he found it. It had been dead, hanging like a broken umbrella from a stretch of chain on the beach. It had tangled a foot in the wire, exhausted itself trying to flap free, and died, upside down, of thirst and starvation. He'd taken it as a specimen, intending to mount the long wing feathers on an armature for study and reduce the carcass to bones for anatomical comparisons. Only when he had brought it back to his shack and laid it on his work table had he realized that a flicker of life remained. He had cleaned it and fed it by hand, using a pipette that, now he came to think of it, was definitely part of the cleaning kit Max had given him for the gun. As it regained strength, it did not express gratitude of any sort. Drusha had been disappointed, but not surprised. He was a Magos biologist and knew from long experience that wild things remained wild and would peck if he got too close. Setting aside his brief, foolish dream of a wise and saturnine companion who would perch around his home and watch him with cold eyes as he shuffled into old age, he had confined it to the cage, intending to release it when it was strong enough. It was still there after 6 months. He had yet to work out a way of opening the cage to let it out without losing several fingers and his eyes. Drusha stood in the pens, breathing hard. He heard the tarkanils chatter and flap, the seabirds yick with agitation, and the damn raptor clack its scissor beak with undisguised contempt. He was as trapped as they were. The man approached the pens. Drusha edged towards the feed store. The raptor bashed at the wire, snapping at him.
"Please be quiet,"
he whispered to it, putting a shushing finger against his lips. It glared at him with fathomless, jet-dot eyes, and resumed its assault on the wire. A light shone in. The door opened. Drusha saw the man silhouetted against the night.
"Show yourself," the man called out. The stab beam swung. "Throne Sag, are you in there? Are you hiding?"
The man took a step forwards. Drusha shrank back, his shoulders against the door of the feed store.
"Take what you want," he cried. "I don't have much, but just take it."
He'd heard that if you allowed the road mobs to pick you clean without arguing, sometimes they let you live.
"I don't want anything,"
the man replied. He sounded surprised. The stab beam found Drusha's cowering, flinching face.
"I've come for you."
Well, that was it then. He was done for. Might as well just string him up from a fence by one foot, like a broken umbrella. At least he knew, now. At least he knew all hope was gone. It gave him an odd sort of strength, a resolve that he'd only managed to summon a couple of times before in his entire life. There was nowhere left to go. His back was against the wall. Well, literally the door of the feed store, but metaphorically a wall, unyielding. He was cornered. Trapped. As on those previous occasions, the sudden resolve unlocked something in him. A will to live, an anger towards the world that thwarted and frustrated him at every last damn turn. He wrenched open the clasp of the end cage. The sea raptor came out like a summoned fury in a blizzard of feathers. Keening, it went for the light and the open door. The man in the doorway yelled out in alarm. The raptor hit him, pecking and raking. He yelped, covered his face, and tried to fight it off. Its wings slammed at him. He lost his footing and fell sideways, the back of his head bouncing off the doorframe. The raptor burst past, up into the night air, wings wide. A second later, Valentin Drusha followed it out of the pens with equal determination, leaping over the body of the man sprawled in the doorway. He saw the raptor high above, its powerful white-fletched wings beating as it banked towards the sea. He felt as if he were flying too, flying free, leaving the horror of the world behind and soaring high into... Something hit him across the mouth and clotheslined him onto his back. The impact knocked his spectacles off. He was stunned for a moment, his head spinning, his mouth full of blood. Another man was standing over him. He was very big, the owner of the shadow at the door. Drusha groped around, found his spectacles, and jammed them back on. They were bent, but he could see the man. He was wearing a jack-armored coat. His head was shaved, rounded and solid like the tip of a large-caliber bullet. He had a goatee. He looked down at Drusha, baffled.
"The hell you playing at?" he asked.
"Don't kill me," Drusha gurgled.
"I'm not going to," the man replied.
Drusha wrenched out the pistol and aimed it at the man's face.
"Do not kill me,"
he cried. The man looked at the gun in annoyance.
"Well, now I want to," he said.
Stab beams bobbed behind him, more people running over.
"Have you found him?"
a voice asked.
"I found someone," said the bald man, frowning at Drusha. "He's got a gun."
"And I'll use it,"
Drusha yelled, lying on his back and brandishing the weapon wildly. The bald man sighed, and, in some manner that Drusha couldn't quite understand, but which clearly involved terrifying reflexes, took the gun out of Drusha's hand.
"No, he hasn't," the bald man called out.
The other figures arrived. They shone their stab lights at him.
"Is this him?" the bald man asked.
"Yes,"
said one of the figures, a woman.
"Valentin Drusha, Magus Biologis."
"He doesn't look like a Magus Biologis," said the bald man. "Just some old loon. Why isn't he wearing any trousers?"
"I was in bed," Drusha wailed.
"With your boots on?" the bald man asked.
"That was after," cried Drusha.
The woman bent down beside Drusha.
"Get up and stop making a fuss, Valentin," she said. "These nice people have come a long way to find you."
Drusha knew her voice. After 15 years, he still knew the smell of her, too. Body heat, leather, a faint fragrance called True Heart that had cost him too much money in a Tycho City perfumery 20 years before.
"Max?"
"Hello, Drusha,"
said Jermaine Max.
"It's been a while."
Chapter 2. A specific area of technical expertise. There were four of them, Max and three others, two men and a woman.
"I made you this,"
the other woman said. She put a tin mug down on the table beside Drusha. She was a finely made woman with very dark skin, her hair tight pinned around her head. Drusha could not guess her age. 30, perhaps. She wore gloves and an embroidered cerise jacket.
"What is it?"
Drusha asked, dabbing at his split lip.
"Caffeine," she said.
"I don't have any caffeine," he replied.
The woman frowned and gestured towards the kitchen.
"Brown powder, silver tin, second shelf, marked caffeine."
"A sample of desiccated tree fox droppings for analysis," said Drusha.
She nodded, thoughtfully, then shrugged.
"Probably better not drink it, then," she advised.
They had brought him inside and allowed him to get dressed. The bald man had not given him back his gun. Drusha's mouth, jaw, and neck hurt from the blow that had knocked him down. He was fiddling with his spectacles, but the frames were still bent. No one had even said sorry. Max came in, pulled out the other chair, and sat facing Drusha. He hadn't seen her in 15 years. Her short hair was just beginning to lose its depth of color, but she still looked good. He could see the tiny zigzag scar above the left-hand side of her mouth and the trace of the other scar on her forehead. Both were old now, faded, like memories. She wore the uniform of a magistrate and marshal. Beside her, he felt ancient.
"I heard you retired," he said.
"Didn't suit me," she said. "The division was understaffed, so I took reassignment."
"Tycho City?"
She shook her head.
"Ankara province, up north."
He nodded, as if that meant something.
"Still a silly bastard, I see," she said. "When someone knocks on your door, you don't run away and attack them with eagles."
"You do out here," said Drusha.
She raised her eyebrows.
"Why are you living like this, Valentin? In this dump? Alone?"
"Well, odd as it may sound, there is very little in the way of paid work available for a highly qualified Magus Biologis on Gershom," he said.
a fact that I have wrestled with for, let me see now, 34 years, and a detail I wish I had been aware of when, as a young man with splendid prospects, I took the commission to do a survey of the planet's indigenous fauna, and ended up stuck here for the rest of my...
Don't start, she said. He opened his mouth to carry on, but he saw the look on her face. It was a self-pitying rant she'd heard from him too many times. He cleared his throat.
It also appears from experience, he said, less emphatically, that I do not make for sparkling company, and so an isolated existence is better for everyone. Someone once told me I'd be happier alone, or that I'd make others happier if I was alone. I don't recall precisely. There was a lot of shouting and door-slamming.
Max sighed and looked away.
Did you train that eagle?
Drusha glanced around. The younger, blonde man was sitting on a bench in the corner. He was holding a dressing to the gashes on his cheek and neck.
It was a sea raptor, said Drusha.
What?
Asked the blonde man.
A sea raptor, not an eagle. Gortus gortus geshomi.
Uh-huh, said the man. I asked if you trained it.
No.
Then a control implant of some kind?
No.
Is he Saikana?
Asked the bald man. He was suddenly standing in the doorway behind Drusha.
No, he's not, said Max.
Good, said the bald man, because, you know...
I let a wild thing out, and you were in the way, said Drusha to the younger, blonde man.
Ah, but you knew Varier was in the way, said the bald man. And you knew what would happen.
Yes,
said Drusha. He hesitated, then looked over at the blonde man.
I'm sorry, he said.
Varier shrugged.
It's fine, he replied. It was smart thinking, actually. Yeah, growled the bald man. If we'd been a road mob, you'd have eagled the crap out of us.
What is this about? Drusha asked.
He was looking directly at Max, the only person in the room he felt he could consider a friend, and even then, not much of one.
Who are these people?
The blonde man got to his feet. With his free hand, he took out a rosette and showed it to Drusha.
Interrogator Dara Vorier, Ordo Hereticus, he said. These are my associates, Medea Betancourt and Harlan Nail.
Valentin Drusha didn't hear much beyond the word Ordo. It felt as though a trap door had opened under him and plunged him into a world where there would never, ever be enough anxiety meds.
We have need of assistance, said Nail, the big bald man. A specific area of technical expertise. You came highly recommended.
By the Marshal, I presume? Asked Drusha, wiping his lips. Max had produced a hip flask of Amasek and let Drusha take a swig to steady his nerves.
Yes, said Vorier.
I don't do consultations, said Drusha.
What are you, retired? Sneered Nail. Living in your beachfront property? Training eagles?
No.
I think I just heard you complaining there were piss-all opportunities for employment here on Gershom, said Nail.
Does this pay? Asked Drusha.
Yes, said Nail, in the form of deep satisfaction and pride at having served the Emperor of Mankind and his Inquisition.
I thought so, said Drusha.
There's a stipend and expenses, said Vorier.
Is there?
Maybe, said Nail. Name a fee. Bear in mind you're laboring under the false impression that you have any choice in this. The Inquisition needs your help. It's not a yes-no option.
Drusha looked across the table at Max. Panic was beginning to set in.
Why did you bring these people here? He hissed. What have you got me into? Why are you doing this to me again?
They need a Magus Biologus, Valentin, she said.
Well, they can find someone else, said Drusha. I'm not going to get dragged into another one of your insane adventures. Come on, Valentin. Outer Urdar was fun. And Tycho City? We went to the zoo.
So, you have history?
Asked Medea Betancourt.
We do, said Max. Which is why I brought him to you. A history of insane adventures, said Betancourt. In, what was it, Outer Urdar and...
It's possible he was referring to the 3 years we were married, said Max. Nail snorted.
It's not funny, said Drusha.
I'm absolutely certain it wasn't, said Nail. For her.
Drusha got up and tried to appear dignified.
Look, sir, he said, I am a Magos biologist. I study flora and fauna, make taxonomies. I have been here on Gershom for more than 30 years. I wish I hadn't been, but there you go.
It's not much of a life. However, it's what I do. Twice in the past, Marshal Max has co-opted my assistance in certain matters. The last time was 20 years ago. They were dangerous experiences, very much outside my wheelhouse. I do not wish to repeat them. Ever. So, I suggest you look for somebody more qualified to help with whatever it is you're doing.
Thing is, said Nail, there's no one more qualified. Not in this system. No one else even qualified, period. You're the only Magos biologist. Marshal Max didn't recommend you because she thought you were particularly good. She recommended you because you were the only Magos biologist she knew.
Drusha sat down again. Max looked at Nail sharply. You really didn't have to tell him that, she said. Nail shrugged. I know what he's like, Max went on. He'll mope now. Sulk. We'll never get him to cooperate.
Wow, murmured Drusha. You're making it better all the time.
I'll make him cooperate, said Nail.
Betancourt raised a gloved hand.
First of all, she said, we're on a clock. He's waiting for us. I don't want to keep him waiting much longer, do you? And I'd rather we brought this gentleman along in a cooperative frame of mind than drag him unwillingly. So there must be something he wants, something that will make it worthwhile for him.
He wants to get off this planet, said Max. Drusha looked at her. She was serious. He's wanted nothing more since the day I met him. One-way passage.
Where do you want to go? Asked Fourier.
Drusha swallowed hard.
Anywhere,
he said quietly.
Anywhere that isn't here.
Fourier looked at Betancourt.
We can do that. Get him somewhere. Gudrun?
Thracian Primaris?
You'd pay for a travel bond? Asked Drusha.
We've got a ship, said Betancourt.
Drusha began packing some belongings in an old Munitorum kit bag. His house was full of clutter, but when it came down to it, there were very few items he felt he had to take. His journals, the manuscript of his taxonomy, his sketchbooks. He wasn't sure any of that even mattered, but he felt obliged to take them. Something to show he hadn't entirely wasted the previous 34 years.
What is the issue?
He asked Nail.
Wildlife problem, up north. Unkara province.
And the work involves?
Insane adventures. You won't like it.
I will be resolved. I can be resolved, you know.
When the offer is right, said Nail.
Drusha stiffened.
I'm not a mercenary, he said.
Nail shrugged.
I am,
he replied. He looked at Drusha.
Just to be fair, he said, you say you've had insane adventures.
I have.
I'm sure. I'm also sure that whatever escapades you and the Marshal have enjoyed in the past, they're nothing. Nothing compared to what we do.
You underestimate what...
No,
said Nail.
Then you're boasting.
Not that either. I'm just trying to tell it to you straight, in all fairness. This isn't going to be like anything you've known before.
It must be like something I've known, sir, said Drusha, or you wouldn't need my expertise.
Nail thought about that.
Well, you know animals, he admitted. You know how to let a wild thing out of a cage, and what will happen when you do. This is going to be like that, only in reverse.
Putting something back in a cage?
Mm-hmm. We'll do the heavy graft. We just need expertise, identification, insight, that sort of thing.
Drusha fastened the kit bag.
Ready?
Nail asked.
Yes, said Drusha.
He paused.
No, wait. Cages. You reminded me. I'll be right back. 2 minutes.
He went outside, to the back of the property. It was nearly dawn. The sky had turned mauve over the white dunes. It almost looked beautiful. Typical, Drusha thought, now that I'm finally leaving. He went to the pens and opened the cages one by one, shooing out the tarkanils and the seabirds. He couldn't leave them caged up and not come back. He threw down some feed for them, and they started to peck, strutting around the little yard, warily. They'd have to fend for themselves. It wasn't kind, but it was kinder than leaving them penned up to starve. He looked at the property. He wasn't coming back. He wouldn't miss it. He realized he was being watched. The sea raptor was perched on a fence strut at the top of the dunes. It should have been down the coast by now, or out to sea, but there it was, watching him. Drusha took off his spectacles, cleaned the lenses on the hem of his shirt so he could see better, and put them back on.
The sea raptor ruffled its wings, then spread them and powered down in one long swoop, landing on the ridge of the pens above him. It clacked its proud beak. Drusha smiled.
"So, all those months of being a bastard," he said to it softly, "and you wanted to stay after all? You could have sat on the back of my chair at night, watched me work. Go on, Mal, you're free."
The raptor tilted its head and studied him.
"Go on," he said. "I'm going. You can go too. But thanks for seeing me off and everything."
The raptor tilted its head the other way and opened its beak. He could see the sharp spear of its tongue. Such a majestic creature. So it stooped from the roof ridge into the yard, killed one of the pecking tarkanils outright, and took off with it in its talons. He watched it fly away into the dawn sky, lugging the limp prey with hefty beats of its wings. A few tarkanil feathers drifted in the air around Drusha like snowflakes.
"Typical," Drusha said. "Who are you talking to?"
asked Max, stepping through the back door.
"Myself," said Drusha.
"Ready?"
"I'm supposed to be a Magos biologist, Germain, but every day I realize I know nothing about anything. You sure you want me for this?"
"Not really," she said.
"But we're going anyway."
Chapter 3 Helter Fortress. Several roads converged in Ankara town, the highways from the peninsula to the south, and the western routes through to Otten and the ocean. And the least of them, a track, wound north into the hills for 10 kilometres until it found the fortress. The hills were not hills. They had earned that insufficient title in ages past, because they were a 400-kilometre spur of the Tartrid range, and all peaks on Gershom were hills compared to those monsters. They towered in their own right, younger mountains, sharp-edged, clothed in evergreen forests below their shoulders, sweeping up into spires of naked dark granite. They were called the Ankaran Hills, known too as the Karanines, and they formed the northern and eastern limits of the province. Their older, glowering cousins, the Tartrids, could be seen, from high ground on a clear day, as a blue shadow 200 kilometres away, like the front wave of a great deluge, frozen solid and forever about to roll in and sweep the province away. The history of the territory had been fraught. It had evaded Gershom's recent conflicts, including the long and complex civil war that had ravaged the peninsula, spared by its outlying state and lack of significance. But the fortresses that clung to the long spur of the hills spoke of older disputes. Outer Udar lay to the east of the Tartrid's flanks, and in the early days of settlement its territories had bred fierce nomadic peoples with an expansionist mindset. Long, ungainly wars of invasion and repulsion had haunted the Karanine Belt. No one studied them anymore. The deeds and efforts of those wars were remembered only by the pages of history texts that slept on the library shelves of Ankara town and were never opened. The sites of skirmishes and battles were lost in the woodland slopes and valleys, so overgrown and misplaced that even their particular significances and causes had vanished. Occasionally a farmer, grazing high pasture, or a woodsman in the deeper forest, would stumble on a rusted buckle or spear tip or a piece of bone that was not an animal's, and realize that something had once happened in that empty place. Only the fortresses remained as any kind of memorial to an age of conflict. Raised in the dark granite of the Karanines, they had taken longer to fade into nature. Most were gone, heaps of stone scattered on lonely hillsides, stumps of wall furred with moss, lingering in forest twilight. Some had endured. Tala Keep, far to the west of Ankara town, was a ruin, but its architecture was so cyclopean and its prospects so magnificent, it had enjoyed a romantic afterlife as a site for visitors, hunters, recreational walkers, and a few amateur historians. Corlock Fort, another ruin, was less accessible, but it had survived in a local children's rhyme and in the name of two hostelries in the town. Helter Fortress was the most complete. It was the closest of all the fortresses to the town, and for the 2 centuries following its duties as a stronghold, it had served as the home of the Karanine proctors, then as the summer retreat of the provincial governor, and finally as the estate of a local dignitary called Essek Fargul, who had retired there to enjoy the rewards of a successful career in the timber industry. Fargul's wealth had run out 5 years before his health. Helter sank into neglect, and the old man died there, alone, in a draughty bedchamber on the fifth floor of the tower. Helter Fortress was shut up at his passing. Its windows were boarded over, its gates chained, and weeds took up residence. No one had lived there, or even visited, for 30 years. Chapter 4 Heuristic Amplification Disciplines. Garafar found Audla Jaff where he had left her in the old man's library. She was still reading, but he noticed it was a different book from the one she had been intent on an hour earlier. An early rain had come up after dawn. Garafar could hear it pattering at the plastic sheeting they'd taped across Helter's broken windows, and tapping at what glass remained. There were wooden shutters, but Jaff had opened them for light, despite the glow-globes she had set around her perch on the ratty old chaise. It had been 2 weeks since he'd met her, and he still didn't know what to make of her. Elfin, with a frame like a boy, and a high forehead that made the curve of her brow seem huge, and very young, younger than him. She was smart, he knew that. Big eyes, like new coins, a tiny, pinched mouth. He understood she was some kind of expert retained by the visitor. With the visitor absent, she was in charge. He stood for a moment, feeling awkward, rain dripping off the leather jack of his deputy's uniform.
"I've done a sweep," he said.
"Are your colleagues on station?"
she asked. She didn't look up. She turned a page.
"Yes, ma'am," he said.
He thought of Cronil, sheltering from the rain in the gatehouse, and Edda walking the west wall with her riot gun under her slicker.
Any word from him?" he asked.
She closed the book and picked up another from a pile beside her.
"No,"
she said.
"You don't think something might have..."
"No,"
she said. She was intent on the book.
"It's possible that something has, of course, but I doubt it. He knows what he's doing. Is there any sign of the others?"
He shook his head.
"Did you check the cold store?" she asked.
"Yes," he said.
She raised her head and looked at him, the slightest hint of a question.
"You're reading, ma'am,"
he said, changing the subject.
"I am,"
she said, looking right at him.
"A book."
Jaff looked down at the book in her hands and reacted as if surprised to see it there. Garafar had noticed her sense of humour before. It was at odds with her serene, cerebral manner. It seemed older than she was.
"I am," she said.
"Anything in particular?" he asked.
"This?"
she asked, gesturing with the book, a slim volume.
"Folk Verse of the Carinine Passes by Nettie O'Farrell, second edition, published by the Red Grange Press in Delkey 78 years ago, some watermarking, foxing and shelfware, inscribed on the flyleaf, 'To my dear nephew Essek, your beloved aunt.'"
She rolled off the details rapidly without even consulting the book.
"Good, is it?"
he asked. Jaff rose to her feet, unfolding her legs from under her. She was significantly shorter than him.
"You have a tell, Deputy Garafar."
"A tell?"
"Several. In this case, a slight twitch of the masseteric ligament on the left side. A micro-expression that indicates annoyance or aggravation. You wonder why I am reading and not working. You ask if the book is good, when what you want to ask is why it's you who has to do the patrol sweep in the rain. The answer to your unvocalized question is that I am researching. I am not reading for recreation. I am investigating Essek Fargal's library, or at least those parts of it that have not been reduced to pulp by damp and insect activity."
Garafar glanced around the library. It had to hold upwards of 10,000 books.
"You pick books at random?"
"No, I am working methodically."
Garafar couldn't hide a laugh.
"You're reading them all? The entire library?"
"Yes."
"Good luck with that, ma'am," he smiled. "I guess you'll be here a few years after we've all gone."
"Why?"
"Well, to read all the books, I mean."
"I have 117 more to go,"
she said.
"You're joking," he said.
"I must be,"
she said with a flash of raised eyebrows.
"You can't have read... I mean, we've been here a couple of weeks."
She put the book down.
"You really don't know what a savant is, do you, Deputy?"
Garafar thought he did, but clearly he didn't.
"You could explain,"
he suggested.
"Do you know what the heuristic amplification disciplines of the Neo-Distaff Institute are?"
she asked.
"I do not, ma'am."
"Then a direct explanation would be ineffective. Do you know what a sponge is?"
"Yes,"
he replied tightly.
"Then I am a sponge, and data is water.
I see, he said.
Do you know what a metaphor is, Deputy?
I do, Mum.
And according to your masseteric ligament, you know what condescension is, too. So I apologize for that. Now let's discuss your lateral cheek septum.
My...
Your other tell, Deputy, said Jaff. A micro-twitch. When I mentioned the cold store, you lied. You didn't check it.
Garifar sighed.
No, Mum. I know I should have, but it's a waste of time. All those bodies, I mean, they're not going anywhere.
Can you say that with certainty, Deputy? She asked.
Garifar didn't reply. He heard the rain pattering on the plastic sheeting. He felt cold, colder than he should have, even in the damp, draughty room, half open to the Carinine weather. It had sounded like a pretty interesting assignment when Max had put him on it. A major case, murders, killings, the talk of Unkara town, the idea that external investigators had arrived. No one had outrightly said so, but Garifar was pretty sure they were connected to the Ordos. Big stuff, the sort of thing that didn't happen in a backwater province, the sort of thing that could get an ambitious junior officer noticed, and maybe lead to advancement, because opportunities in the Carinines were scarce, especially when the Marshal showed zero signs of ever wanting to retire, like she should have done years ago, and make way for new blood. But it had turned out to be much less comfortable. Cold, wet, tedious, yet with a constant undercurrent of something Garifar felt was malevolent, like a storm waiting to break. It wasn't the bodies. He'd seen plenty of bodies. Accidents, bar fights, farming mishaps, plus a brief tour in the local militia during the last years of the Civil War, before he joined law enforcement. Bodies didn't faze him, though the number and the manner of death in this case was unusual. What unsettled him was something he couldn't put his finger on, like they were poking at something that shouldn't be poked, or opening a cage that had been locked for a damn good reason. And that lead investigator was a piece of work, scary as hell in his own right. If it had been up to Garifar, the lead investigator would have made it onto the list of suspects, just turning up in a town like that, with his cruel manner and his band of disreputable henchmen. But it wasn't up to Garifar. Hadid Garifar was just a deputy with an assistant investigator's ticket. He was local enforcement. He was muscle. He did as he was told.
"Let's check the cold store together," said Jaff. "I want to take some ambient measurements anyway."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Good," he said.
"Measurements of ambient what?"
"Just ambient," she replied.
She buttoned her coat. Then she looked at him.
"I hear an engine," she said. "Approaching."
"The others must be back, ma'am," he replied.
"Hmm. If they are, they've changed vehicle."
"How can you tell?" he asked.
"It sounds different," she said.
Deputy Cronel had opened the gates to let the transporter enter the yard. He stood watching, his riot gun hooked over the crook of his arm as it came to a halt. Deputy Edda had appeared on the top wall to add cover. The transporter was a Cargo 4, an all-terrain variant, spattered in mud from the forest track. It pulled up beside the green ATV and the heavy, bronze Marshal Division transporter already parked there. Garifar followed Audla Jaff into the yard. The hatches popped on the Cargo 4, and five people got out. Garifar's boss, Max, and three of the investigators' team, the suave Vorier, the big thug Nail, and Mamselle Betancourt, whose beauty stopped Garifar in his tracks every time he saw her. It looked like someone had taken a swing at Vorier. There was a dressing strapped around his face. That pleased Garifar no end. Vorier was an arrogant bastard. He was of a type Garifar knew too well. Privately schooled cadet officers in the Territorial Guard, petulant aristos, privileged rich kids from the cities who rolled into Unkara every summer season to hunt and drink and sail the lakes, and generally harass any female they could find. They had rich fathers who retained expensive lawyers who, in turn, could disappear any indiscretions. The fifth man looked like a vagrant. He was old and pale and thin to the point of being haggard. His hair was grey, and he wore a shabby checkered suit and an overcoat that had outlived several previous owners. Little wire-frame spectacles perched on his face. The frames were bent, and they gave him a cockeyed appearance. This was the expert they'd gone off to locate.
"Morning, Chief,"
Garifar called to Max. She nodded back. She was handing down a kit bag that was apparently the extent of the expert's luggage. The expert was standing nearby, adjusting his spectacles and looking around as if he'd never seen daylight or old high walls before.
"Garifar, this is Magus Biologist Drusha," Max said.
"Sir?" Garifar nodded curtly.
"Find him a room and give him a hand with his bag. We'll brief in 20 minutes.
"Yes, ma'am," said Garifar. He picked up the kit bag. "Fifth floor is free," he said.
Max shook her head.
"Stick him on the fourth, near to me. If you put him on the fifth, someone will tell a ghost story about the old man dying up there and we'll never hear the bloody end of it."
The expert, Drusha, scowled at her.
"I'm not a child, Max," he said. "I don't believe in ghosts. An old building where someone once died, so what?"
"I know what you can get like, Valentin," she replied.
"I presume the bedding has been changed since this old man died in it?" he asked.
She nodded.
"Stick him on the fifth, then, deputy," she said. "You were gone a long time,"
Jaff said to Vorier.
"Delayed," Vorier replied. "The transporter broke down outside Ottofan. Transaxle. We had to rent another ride."
Jaff looked at Garifar and flashed her eyebrows again. Scary bitch. How could she tell that just from a distant noise?
"Brief in 20, Max repeated. "Is he here?"
"No," said Jaff.
"You could have briefed me on the road," said Drusha. "It was a long enough journey."
"Some things you need to see for yourself before they make sense," said Nail.
Garifar led Drusha up to the fifth floor.
"Old place,"
Drusha remarked.
"Yes."
"Unoccupied?"
"Before us, yes, for years."
"Nice views,"
said Drusha, pausing to look out of one of the window slits.
"I suppose."
"I bet you get a lot of hill browns up here. Pine finch, crosshammers, goldhawks, and lots of charhoops in autumn."
"I couldn't say,"
said Garifar. Drusha shrugged and continued climbing the stairs after him.
"What happened to Vorier's face?"
Garifar asked.
"I attacked him with an eagle," said Drusha.
Garifar stopped.
"Really?"
he asked.
"Not really," Drusha replied. "But that appears to have become the narrative, despite my attempts to correct it, so I'm just going along with it."
The flaking stone steps led up to a landing where the floor was boarded with wood. It had once been polished, fine surface, but water damage from the leaking roof had stained it, making it patchy and rough. Buckets and other open vessels had been set at strategic points to catch drips. Some were so full, puddles were spreading around them.
"Along here," said the deputy. "Mind your step."
"They haven't told me much," said Drusha.
"About what?"
"About anything. This matter, this case, this investigation."
Garifar looked at him.
"I get the feeling a lot of it's classified, sir," he said.
"You don't know?"
asked Drusha.
"I'm just local law, sir," he said. "Staffing, support, you know."
"So, it's classified by the Ordos, then?"
asked Drusha, more to himself. Deputy Garifar's manner suddenly became keen. He looked Drusha in the eye.
"So they are from the Ordos?"
he asked.
"Inquisition?"
Drusha nodded.
"Yes, I saw a badge. Vorier identified himself. Didn't you know?"
"No,"
replied Garifar.
"They don't say much about anything. The Marshal was already investigating this case when they sort of turned up and took over. She's cooperating. It's not like her to just roll over. It feels like they have something on her."
"Not Max," said Drusha.
"You know her?"
"From way back."
"Well, I suppose if they are from the Ordos, that would explain her compliance," said Garifar. "Her eagerness to assist. I mean, that's how it works, doesn't it? The Inquisition has authority everywhere."
"As I understand it. What was the case?"
"Sir?"
"The case Marshal Max was investigating,"
asked Drusha. Garifar hesitated.
"Oh, come on, Deputy Garifar," said Drusha, pausing slightly to squint and read the officer's name badge. "I let slip they were from the Ordos. It's your turn. Like you said, they're playing it close. Even my old friend Max."
Garifar shrugged.
"There was a death last winter. A farmer found the body. Open and closed, really. Or should have been. Ursid Gill."
"Ursa Minora Gershomi?" said Drusha. "Or Majora, I suppose. Or even a cave Ursid, though those are rare these days."
"Sir?"
"A banded Ursid or a big grey?"
"Yeah, we get both kinds up here. The king greys once in a while. So we thought some poor idiot left the wood path, got taken. Never got an identification on the victim, though. No papers. We ran genetic samples through the system, and even shared them with other networks. Then, in the spring, there were two more. Same deal.
Found together?
No, said Garifar. Kilometers apart. Within days, another. Then another a month after.
Five. All male?
No, four male, one female.
All unidentified?
Yeah, which is odd. We get a lot of visitors up here in season, hunters and the like, plus nice views, like you said, so people from outside the province aren't unusual. But five unknowns, that started to feel off.
Was there feeding?
They were all ursid kills. Oh, yeah, said Garifar. All the meat was gone, all the organs. Funny, that's the first question the marshal asked.
Drusha smiled. She remembered the basics, he said.
She wanted it squared away, certainly. I mean, we get the odd animal attack, but five felt like there might be a rogue beast. Plus the identification thing. Max, she ordered up some expensive facial reconstruction on three of the bodies. Then we ran the results around every hostelry, tavern and guest house in the area. I mean, it was possible we had five dead visitors who all happened to not have papers on them, or who had their papers eaten along with them.
Unlikely, said Drusha.
But possible. No point seeing patterns where there aren't any. But nothing. No one recognized them. So the reconstructs went out on the wire, too.
And that brought the Ordos in?
Yes, said Garifar. But before they got here, we found the rest.
The rest of what?
The rest of the bodies, sir. It was spring, like I said. The thaw. Warmest spring in a decade. There was meltwater flooding in this valley and the next along. It brought bodies down. People who'd been dead since last year that we hadn't found because they'd been frozen up. The tech adepts say some of them might even be from the year before. Or as long ago as 8 years.
All ursid kills?
The exact same specs, sir. Ursid kill, unidentified subjects. Two more of them female.
How many bodies?
Asked Drusha. I don't know, sir, said Garifar.
Oh, come on, deputy. You're on the case. How many bodies?
I mean to say, I don't know what the total's going to be. We've got 18 so far. They're still digging up more.
Drusha opened his mouth to speak. Nothing much was forthcoming.
We've got all the bodies downstairs, in the cold store, said Garifar.
Here?
Yes, orders of the lead investigator. He wanted all the bodies in one place for examination, so they set up a facility in the cellars where it's cold.
That's ridiculous, said Drusha. You need a proper morgue and laboratory to conduct.
Orders of the lead investigator, Garifar repeated.
Well, he sounds like an idiot, said Drusha.
Oh, he's not, said Garifar. I don't know what he is apart from damn scary, but he's not an idiot.
I disagree, and I'll tell him so to his face, said Drusha. I've only ever assisted law enforcement cases, but I know well enough there's a proper procedure for this kind of thing. They had reached a door. This the haunted bedroom, deputy? Drusha replied.
Well, the old man died here years ago, replied Garifar.
Which old man?
Fargle, last person to own this place. I don't think he's still here, so you'll be all right.
He opened the door, and they went in. It had once been a grand bedroom, but the plaster was crumbling, and the boards were bare. Large windows, the shutters open, overlooked the valley below. It smelled damp. Drusha and Garifar halted in their tracks. There was a man standing by one of the windows, his back to them. He was staring out. He was tall, broad and solid, his bulk covered in a long black coat.
"Throne, but you scared me!" exclaimed Garifar. "I didn't know you were back, sir."
The man turned to look at them. It was impossible to discern his age. His craggy face was grizzled and badly scarred. Augmetic plugs and leads trailed back from pinch points and sockets in his hairless scalp and disappeared down under his high collar. His expression was impenetrable.
"That will be all, deputy," he said. "Shall I tell the others that you're—"
"That will be all," the man said.
"Unless you'd like to stay and discuss the unguarded sharing of confidential matters with outsiders."
Garifar put the bag down, shot a look at Drusha, and left.
"You're Drusha?" the man asked, staring at Drusha. "The one Max recommended."
"I am," said Drusha.
"My name is Eisenhorn," the man said. "I believe there was something you wanted to tell me to my face."
Chapter 5.
Classified. Drusha followed the Inquisitor back downstairs. The rain had come up again, and he could hear it pelting against the thick walls.
"I didn't mean anything by it," he said.
"I don't really care,"
replied Eisenhorn. It was a slow descent. The Inquisitor lumbered. His legs and lower body were braced inside some kind of augmetic exo-support. Every step was a heavy effort, every movement marked by the puff of hydraulic servos. Drusha had often thought himself old and in bad shape, but he was nimble beside the other man. How did a body even keep going after what must have been years of damage and injury? Surely there came a point at which enough was enough. There was an ugly stink of obsession coming off Eisenhorn, the stench of a man driven beyond reason to accomplish something. When was enough enough? Only in death. Drusha had heard that phrase often enough over the years, the noble mantra of the military. It was nonsense, obviously. Only an idiot thought that, or an idiot who pretended to be a hero. An idiot either way. Drusha's initial evaluation of the Inquisitor had not changed, though he decided to keep that to himself. No point making his bad start worse. Sure, this Eisenhorn fellow was intimidating. He had the badge and the terrifying authority that came with it. But he was just another idiot of which the galaxy had so many. A man with delusions of grandeur. A man who felt he could make some kind of difference in the grand scheme of things. A man who believed his work mattered. Try making a complete taxonomy and tell me that matters, Drusha thought. Try doing that for 7 years and tell me it wasn't hard work.
Perhaps you can tell me more about this investigation, said Drusha.
Isn't that why you're here? To tell me more about it?
Well, I'll need something to go on, said Drusha.
I think Deputy Garofar told you plenty.
I just asked him casually. He wasn't really sharing classified information or anything.
Eisenhorn paused and glanced at him.
In this situation, I decide what is classified, Magos.
Holy throne, you're an asshole, thought Drusha. I get it. You're tough as anything, and years of privileged authority have gone to your head. You're not impressing me at all with this get-a-load-of-me act. Given the shape you're in, mental, I'm guessing, as much as physical, you should have retired years ago.
Maybe, now you're here, you can share some details, said Drusha, curtly. You want a Magos biologist with specific expertise in the fauna of this planet.
And you want passage off this world, replied Eisenhorn. So, that seems a reasonable basis for cooperation.
So, I just do what you tell me to do? Asked Drusha.
That would be adequate, Eisenhorn replied.
He continued down the stairs. Drusha pulled a face, then hurried to catch up.
A reasonable basis for cooperation would be an exchange of data, he said. I have questions.
Proceed.
Why have you taken this case away from local enforcement?
That's classified. Ordo business.
Great. Have you always operated in such an unorthodox manner?
Also essentially classified. But for the sake of this discussion, yes.
Would it kill you to tell me more about this?
Yes.
I didn't mean literally, said Drusha.
I did,
said Eisenhorn.
Do you find that people who meet you end up regarding you as an arrogant son of a bitch? Snapped Drusha.
Eisenhorn stopped. He did not look around.
I mean, come now, sir, said Drusha. I'm trying to assist. Could you ease off with the hard-nosed act?
It's not an act, Magos.
Terror's sake, Drusha sneered.
Did someone once hurt you really, really badly? Eisenhorn slowly turned around to look at Drusha. Drusha took a step back.
The list of people in this galaxy who have not hurt me is very, very short, Magos, he said.
Drusha adjusted his spectacles, pursed his lips, and nodded.
You've asked some questions, said Eisenhorn. My turn. What is the average bite radius of Ursa Minora Gershomi?
12 centimeters.
Majora?
A range up to 17, said Drusha. 19 for the Arctic form. The cave ursid,
is an ultra-rare prehistoric form, said Eisenhorn. It has probably been extinct for some centuries. If it exists at all, it is restricted to the northernmost area of Outer Udar.
Oh, it exists, said Drusha, or at least it did 30 years ago. I have examples and evidence in my taxonomy. And you're wrong about its locale. There were still some in the Tartrid Mountains.
Are there any other apex predators on this planet whose kills would resemble those of the banded or grey ursids?
Not to an expert. You can't rule out introduced exotics, of course.
You've seen that here?
More than once. Marshal Max will corroborate this.
Why do you want to leave, Gershom?
Asked Eisenhorn. The question took Drusha aback slightly. My work is complete, he replied. It has been for years. A complete taxonomy. It's simply a case that there is nothing left to be done. But, unfortunately, economic circumstances prevent...
You could have retired, said Eisenhorn. I hear that's nice.
I sort of had, sir. Forced to by circumstance. I had a property down on the Bone Coast and, worked with maritime ornithological efforts.
You kept birds in a cage in a shack on the beach, Magos, said Eisenhorn. Your retirement was enforced, by your own admission. If you had been able to leave Gershom at any point in the last 3 decades, you would have done so.
Yes.
Because, somewhere, there were still things to be done, things to be found, secrets to be learned.
Yes.
So it's fair to say that you would not have retired, given the choice, because there is still so much work to be done?
I suppose so, said Drusha.
Work that you really want to do, and which you would prefer not to leave in the hands of others to finish.
Yes, said Drusha. Rain beat against the walls.
I think we are beginning to find an accommodation, Magos, said Eisenhorn. You have let your light go out. I'm sorry for that. I have not let mine die yet. There is work still to be done on Gershom. Work I do not wish to leave to others. You can assist me, for it intersects with your area of speciality. And perhaps, in assisting, you may discover that there is still, and always will be, work of your type for you to commit your life to. As, I think, you always intended.
Show me the bodies, sir, said Drusha.
You have a copy of your taxonomy?
I do, said Drusha.
I ask that you show it to my savant, Audler Jaff. She will only need it for 30 minutes.
He resumed walking. Drusha stood and watched him plod away painfully down the steps. A thought clarified. Hey, sir, Drusha called after him. How did you know I was even thinking about issues of retirement?
Eisenhorn did not look back or reply.
Drusha hurried down the stairs after him. How did you know that? He called. And how did you know I wanted to call you an idiot? In the cold main hall of Helter Fortress, the gathered team looked up as they heard raised voices. Eisenhorn appeared, striding from the stair arch towards the basement doors.
Sir, Vorier began.
Eisenhorn held up a hand stiffly, not breaking stride.
I'm going to the cold store, he announced. Harlan, Audler, Marshal Max, with me, please.
Drusha appeared, out of breath, red-faced, annoyed. He trotted after the Inquisitor. You've met him, then? Asked Max, grinning. Shut up, Germain, he replied. Chapter 6 The Cold Store. Nail drew back the bolts on the door and opened the cold store. It had been a root cellar, Drusha decided, serving the fortress kitchens through the winter when there had still been a garrison to feed. The walls were whitewashed. There were 18 steel gurneys arranged in rows, green plastic sheeting bagging the bodies. More gurneys were folded and stacked along the wall as if other visitors were presently expected. Monitoring equipment was set up between the gurneys, radiating fields of prickly blue light. It's not cold enough, Drusha said immediately. It's not cold enough, and it's too damp. This is no place for the preservation of organic remains.
Correct, said Eisenhorn. Hence the stasis field generators.
"And if the generator power fails?" asked Drusha.
"Then the fortress is going to start to stink," said Nail.
"And your evidence will be lost," said Drusha.
"Evaluation, please, Magos," said Eisenhorn. "I understand it will be preliminary."
"Preliminary. Very well," Drusha said, nodding. He took off his spectacles, wiped the lenses, and put them back on, but did not move. "These people were not the victims of Ursid attacks," he said. There was a pause. Nail looked at him.
"You haven't even opened a bag yet, Magos," he said, gesturing toward the rows of gurneys.
"Nevertheless," said Drusha.
"Let him continue," said Eisenhorn. "Magos, not Ursid attacks."
"No, sir." "But there was evidence of feeding Valentin," said Max, bewildered. "I mean, gross evidence. You always told me to look for... I think Ursids may have fed..."